What would happen if we chose to really tell the truth about ourselves? I'm not saying that it's true. I'm saying that it's my truth.
You're listening to Hammered.
Cancer, and my name is Larry, and I like a woman that loves everything and everybody because I love everybody and everything. This song was so funny. It was a song from the 70s called The Float On, and it had all these different guys that would, like, you know, tell their sign, their astrological sign, and then they would tell how they love a woman. But anyway, Rosa and I were riding in the car one day and this song came on, and I don't think I had laughed that hard in who knows how many years, I don't know, but it was so hilarious. And what really dawned on me was, you know, I had never been with another person that was my same age. I had always been with someone older than me or younger than me, or even like within 5 years, 3 years, but never someone in the same year. You know, we were both 60, 61. I don't remember now, but anyway, but we were the same age. And so some of the things that we had in common, you know, when you think about things, like if you're with somebody super young or super older than you, then, you know, if you say, hey, do you remember that movie, blah, 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 or that song, blah, 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 they're like, not really. You know, so that was a thing that we both had in common that was really fun. And some of the songs that we would send songs back and forth to each other, which was a lot of fun. And, you know, so that was something that that I really, really enjoyed and was really loving, the fact that just being open to laugh and to relax in that way. You know, the thing about the past is I've learned that I have to respect my past, but I also have to be open to my future. And being open to the future just means, you know, not trying to control anything, not try to figure out an outcome, and not try to figure anything out. Just to be in that moment and in that feeling of goodness and happiness as it unfolds. And that's like what was happening with us. And we had both decided to basically let each other off of the hook from the get-go, you know. And what that meant was, hey, I'm letting you off the hook here because you're not responsible for my happiness. And I want you to let me off the hook because I'm not responsible for your happiness. And, you know, outside circumstances, really, unless I let them, they can't control the way I feel. And working on unconditional love and an unconditional lifestyle is what I had been doing ever since, all the way back to the Helena Grease thing, which I hate to keep bringing up, but it's true. But I was really trying, and not just in love relationships or romantic relationships, but personal relationships, friendships, you know, workmates, people in my life every day that might ruffle me in some way or the other. I have to realize I got to look at myself here. And yeah, sometimes people do shit. Sometimes people say things and do inappropriate things. But even then, it's my responsibility to reel it in and to think, okay, I'm not going to take this personal. You know, maybe they're having a bad day, or maybe they're going through something that, you know, I'm not in their shoes. Or maybe they're stuck. And none of it matters. At the end of the day, none of it matters, because if something like that perpetuates, then I have to remove myself from a situation, you know, or vice versa. It's, you know, I truly believe in the laws of the universe, and I truly believe that, you know, there's the law of repulsion. There's the you know, we will repulse the things that no longer work in our lives, just like there's the law of the vacuum, and we will pull in things that are working, or we pull in things to teach us some other lesson. You know, it's this earth is one huge schoolhouse, and we are the little school creatures walking around if we're open to learn. And that's my quest in this life that I guess I'm supposed to do here, because there's something inside of me that won't allow me to not learn. There's something inside of me that pushes me to keep moving forward, and it's forward motion that I have to continue doing, because the alternative for me, how do you go backwards? How do you go live in the past? I don't want to live in the past, you know, and what we do now echoes in eternity. But if I wait for life, life passes me. And, you know, I spent a lot of years waiting for something to happen, or, you know, waiting for that owl of someday. Someday I'll be happy when. And that day never comes. And, you know, I lost some decades in there through work addiction and busyness and urgency disorder and you know, just focusing on, oh, my God, I got so much to do, and I got to please all these people, and I got to make all this money, and I got to pay all these bills, and I got to keep this house, and I got to, until we get to the point of like, what in the fuck is going on here? And each layer that I keep shedding, you know, I'm not shedding layers to heal. I'm not broken. I'm shedding these layers for wellness. It's like I'm focusing on being as healthy as I can while I'm here. And I see it happening right in front of my face. You know, I feel better than I've ever felt in my life. I'm healthier. My doctor, I went for a checkup, which I rarely do, but, you know, to keep your insurance, you got to go do that stuff. And because I don't really even buy into anything basically with Western medicine, because I've just seen too much bullshit going on with it. But that could be a little bit of closed-mindedness, and I don't really care. But, you know, when I went to the doctor and got this full physical, she said, you know, Jill, like, your numbers are better than they've ever been in the time you've been coming here. And I'd been going to this doctor for like 12 years. And she said, what do you think? And I said, you know what it is? I said, I'll tell you what it is. I quit watching the news. I quit watching the media. I quit watching all of that. You know, after that second election and you know who was out of office, I turned it all off. I unplugged. I got rid of Sirius radio in my truck. I do not watch anything. I don't even have news. And yeah, you know, maybe I'm sticking my head in the sand, but I don't really care at this point, because by keeping my head out of the sand, I'm going down into a spiral that's just not healthy. And it's not healthy for the people around me, you know, because that shit's toxic. And I don't care what you say, and you can say whatever you want and judge me about that, but I really don't care anymore about it. I, you know, self-preservation and peace is what I have to focus on. And I, by focusing on that, then that helps other people in the world. You know, and when I go out in the world each day, whether it's through a grocery store line or whatever, you know, I have a vibration coming from me that's lighter than all of that. And I compliment people when they're doing a good job, and I say things to people I love, because I truly know what it feels like to be on the other end of that stick. You know, and I've learned also to say whatever comes to my mind, no matter what it is, but have a safe person that you can say what that really is that's coming out of you. And I felt like I had found that with Rosa. I felt like I could tell her anything, and that we were really sharing and getting to know each other on a deeper level. And true speech really heals. I believe that. And I just, you know, the happiness of my life depends on the quality of my thoughts, and I had to really clean up my thinking. And all I know is that, you know, we have all been touched by a spark of divinity, and there's no denying that. And we all have the capacity to tap into that place. You know, our unconscious existence is the real one. You know, our unconscious is what's real, and our conscious world is what the illusion is, really. My question, I guess, was where am I going and what is my aim here? And I had to not let the old things of the past, the old thoughts of the past, come into play with this new relationship I was starting to build. And there were times, you know, that I felt like I had already felt everything that I was ever going to feel. And I think by, you know, getting to know Rosa and starting on this journey to Italy, I was finding out there's a lot of things I haven't felt before, and I was open to that, and that was exciting to be able to have a whole new lease on some things. And so, you know, we began the journey to Italy, and we were going to the southern Puglia region, and I will probably not pronounce a lot of these names correctly, but I'll do my best with it. And you know, we landed in Bari. It's B-A-R-I, and they say it like body, and I called it Bari. But, you know, and she had sort of prepped me and prepared me, and we were going to be staying at her cousin's. And we flew in, and it was long. It was, we had to go through Paris at Charles de Gaulle Airport and had a little bit of a layover. But, you know, we were both tired, and so we had a few little moments, a little few run-ins of disagreement about no, go this way, no, it says this way, and stuff like that. But it wasn't really a big deal. I think we were both very tired, and, you know, you get a pass on that, or I give a pass on that. I don't take that kind of stuff personally. I'm not keeping score with those things, and I used to back in the old days, you know, but now I know that we all get tense, and I really try to put myself in someone else's shoes. So we got there, and I met her cousins, and it was really a great place we were going to be staying. And we were actually in Molde de Bari, which is below Bari. And it was a smaller town. It was like a little hidden gem. And they didn't have a beach, which was kind of like their ace in the hole. It was sort of keeping the investors out, and it was sort of, you know, keeping it quaint. And it was a small, like a little small fishing village, and it had the beautiful little boats and blue and white boats everywhere, and real colorful on that beautiful water. And, you know, so we would go out and, after we got settled in and everything, the first night we were there, it was like the biggest dinner I've ever had in my entire life, like literally. And it went on for a really long time. I mean, I thought that the dinner that was on the table was the dinner, but that was only the beginning. And it went on and on and on, and, you know. But one of the big, really delightful times, you know how you have like high points, low points, well, was talking to her cousin's husband, Vito. And he was an architect and really intelligent man. And of course, I don't understand a word that's going on. I can catch a word here and there, but Rosa was very gracious to translate. And I ended up having a really good conversation, you know, about history. And I mean, the stuff that really inspires me. And this man was just a plethora of that knowledge. He knew it. And it was so, you know, there were several nights where we had dinners and got to talk. And I love that part of just talking about things that are rich and important, and history making, and where traditions come from and how they come about. You know, things just don't happen by chance. I mean, there are thoughts that become things, and somebody had an idea about something is how all these things come to be. So this trip was very educational for me, and we kind of went on a quest every day. We had a rental car, and Rose was a really good driver, and I was so happy that she was a good driver, and I never really got nervous or anything. It was so, easy to be in a car with her, and sometimes that's just not the case, but we went to so many towns, and each town like has its own vibration, has its own feeling. And there was this one town, and this is really funny because this town is called Monopoly, and the way that the Italians say it is sort of like Monopoly, and I sort of exaggerated, of course, like Monopoly, kind of like I was crying every time I would say it, and so that sort of became a funny thing for us, was are we going to go to Monopoly? But we went there, and there was a castle. I mean, I can't even put it into words, the beauty and the architecture and the stone and the details and the craftsmanship that goes into all these different towns, all these different structures, and just centuries and centuries old. It's very hard for me to describe it. We went to a really good coffee shop in Monopoly, and I wanted two of these coffees. They were so good. I mean, the thing about it is like the espresso and the coffee thing is a thing in Italy, and so that was really great. One of the other towns we went was Polignano Amare, and that was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful town. And we spent a lot of time in there just walking around and taking pictures and just looking. And there were several ones that we sort of went through and, took a quick look or got out for a few, took a few photos or whatever, but I think it was Locarotondo, Ostuni. There was some that were, like I said, more of a drive-through, get out, look around. There was one that has the little houses with the stone roofs, Alibero. I don't know if I said it correctly, but it's pretty famous. There's a couple of them that were pretty well known and more trafficked, a little more touristy. But we found that some of the ones that weren't as touristy were almost more interesting. And in fact, Lecce, 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 that one I really, really loved. And we spent a day down there, and we went into this, it was kind of like a fabric, not really fabric store, but maybe, but they had these beautiful tablecloths that were just exquisite, like the material they were made out of, and these women, they have like clipboards. They're like, it's really high end. And we walk in, and Rosa was looking at a few of the tablecloths, and I just wanted to buy one of those tablecloths for her so bad, and they were really, really expensive. And I was thinking in my mind, one day I'm gonna get her one of those tablecloths. And we had talked about like, kind of daydreamed about what it would be like to buy an apartment in a place like that in one of these small towns, and just kind of do half life over there and half life in the States or something. And that discussion was kind of coming up, and I was just daydreaming and having fantasies about gutting out a little place and redoing it, and it was just really fun to think about those things. And for me, that's part of this journey. That's part of enjoying this journey instead of constantly trying to get to some destination. It's about enjoying and kind of having fun in those thoughts. And so that was something. And then we went to a place called Trani, Trani, and that was a memory that burned out in my brain. That was like everyone almost that we saw was wearing black and white. It looked like I should have taken a picture of it. I didn't take a picture, but there was an outdoor cafe that was huge. There were probably, I would say, 75 people sitting outside, and everybody had on like black pants, one of those black puffy jackets, and maybe a white t-shirt. But it was black and white, and it was the end of March, early April, so it was still kind of, I guess, winter. But I don't really pay that close attention to what people wear. Living in Asheville, it's like people just wear whatever. There's no rules. There's no real clothing etiquette about anything. I go back to when my friend Anne moved from Atlanta to Asheville. Actually, she had not moved there yet. She came to visit me right when I moved there, and we were sitting in Laughing Seed Cafe one evening. It's back when restaurants only served till 8 o'clock in Asheville, and that one was the latest one you could eat dinner. And we were sitting there, and Anne had on like a white blouse, with her collar up and a nice necklace and a really pressed pair of jeans and a belt. Like she was in casual mode, but even her casual mode was very like kind of classy, And she looks around and she looks at me and she goes, "Everybody's like so disheveled." And we busted out laughing. And I said, "That's why I moved here." And we laughed, because the clothing issue had been a thing really my whole life. I mean, my mother had, driven me over to Stone Mountain Park when I was 14 years old and said, "If you're going to wear blue jeans, you can buy them." And said, "Go in there and tell them you're 16, you're big enough." And I had lied to get a job at Stone Mountain Park. And from every paycheck that I ever got from Stone Mountain went to straight to go buy Britannica jeans, Pentimento jeans. It was like when sort of like the cusp of these designer jeans coming out, but of course Levi's. And but I had my own style and I didn't really think anything about it. But I know that Rosa had sort of been telling me like people dress very conservative, they don't wear a lot of color and things like that. But what was very odd to me is that you would walk by these windows, like clothing shops and places, and it would be super colorful. You would have like all kinds of like spring looking colors and suits and attire that was very, very colorful and patterns. And so that was what the juxtaposition was for me, was, well, wait a minute. There's a lot of color here, so why is it such a stigma to wear color? So that part really confused me. And like I said, I was trying to be open to that and trying to jump through those hoops because I didn't want to stand out and I didn't want to make any kind of controversy. And I still even couldn't even understand that as being an issue, but it was. So I respected that, and I respected that that's a cultural thing and that's just something that, when in Rome, no pun, we weren't in Rome, but you kind of have to like adapt yourself. And I'm willing to do that. That's the thing about myself that I've learned is that I have been in a situation for a very, very long time where things were a certain way, and I've been living in Asheville for 23 years, and the Asheville way is not the way it's supposed to be. There's not any certain way that anything's supposed to be, but if you go down to Charleston, South Carolina, you see people, men in seersucker suits and kind of preppy Saturday dresses, and it's so different. And then you go out to Santa Fe and you see this real southwesterny kind of lifestyle. Women in Santa Fe don't color their hair. They have very weathered complexions. It's like people drop some facades when they move to some of these places, Sedona, Arizona, which I haven't been, but I've known some people that have. And so there's a different vibration in everywhere that you go, and that's why going to Italy was a very big education for me. And so that trip was just a very, very fun, interesting trip. And when you spend 3 weeks with somebody that you're kind of having a long distance relationship, that was the longest time that we had spent together. And I felt like that it went pretty well, and there were a few moments, but I don't care who it is, you're going to always, and especially as being such an isolator as I am, there was one night that I did stay back, and she went to another family thing, and I just needed the break. Sometimes I have to retreat and just take a moment to kind of recharge my batteries, and it was fine, and she was fine with that. And that was the thing, is there were no huge expectations put on each other, and I really appreciated that too. So, coming back, we had a really great time there, and then it was time to go back. And like I said, I was going to be in New York or New Jersey with her because my friend Maggie was having the film opening. And so we ended up doing that and got to see Maggie in her glory, and that was wonderful. And I got to hug her afterwards, and I was so proud of her. She's been through a lot of stuff with the passing of her mom, and I can't even imagine at 30 years old losing my mom, who I was close to. I wasn't as close to my mom as she was to her mother, and so I tried to step into a place for her to be a loving figure, not trying to be a mother figure or anything like that, but just to be a person of support and to let her know that I cared, and that's why I flew up to New York to go see this film opening. Just to be there in person, not just send a text, good luck or something, but showing up for somebody. I feel like we've kind of lost touch with that in our society because everything is through our iPhones. We send birthday messages, we just send messages about everything, but to really just show up face to face and say, you're brilliant and you did a great job and I love you. That's just something that I felt was important. And so we did that. And then, it was time for me to go home. And I had gotten sick again. I'd gotten several colds when I would go up there, and it's probably from the plane. But Rosa was very sweet to me and made me homemade chicken soup. And it was just really, really sweet. So time to go back, and spring workload was about to kick in. And so I told Janet and Don, y'all, we got to get this done. And so we finished up the landscaping at their house and the walls, and it was absolutely beautiful, and they were very pleased. I'm happy if the client's happy. That's the main thing for me. So the work started and spring started, and I was back on it. And the good news I had to look forward to, that Rosa was going to come visit in May. And so, it would be like a month or so until we would see each other. But we continued to talk and to communicate, and life was moving along. Jobs were coming up, and I'm working, working, working. And so then it was time for her to come visit, and I was so excited. And so I had sort of, this time she was going to have more time. And so I didn't want to make a big old long schedule of day to day to day, but she sort of likes a little bit of a schedule, I think. And I thought, well, I'll compromise and I'll do some things, but I'm not going to just jam everything up to the point of where there's just no downtime. And so I made some plans for us to visit some different friends and have some meals with some different friends and, go see some waterfalls or just go see some things. And Asheville's a beautiful place, and there's so many different parts of it to see. And so she came, and we were having a great week. And, and then toward the end of the week, I could feel a shift, and I wasn't quite sure, but I started having a lot of anxiety. And, I was really afraid to say anything about it because I felt like it was probably just me. And we had gone to meet a friend, and I don't know, it was like that. By that Friday, it felt like a switch had turned, and I couldn't quite understand it, but I stayed quiet because I didn't want to, push a button or say anything out of line or anything. So I just sort of let the day unfold. And then that night we were coming back from dinner, and it was raining really, really, really heavy. And so we just sat in the truck and waiting for the rain to stop. And as we were sitting there, Rosa says to me, with your casual laid back lifestyle and when your clothes and things, she said, I just don't think we're a real good match. And at first I was kind of like, I almost laughed, like, what? Like, I thought she was joking or something. And then I said, really? And she said, yeah. And it was very, I don't know, my heart started pounding and I was trying to process it in my mind. I kind of got quiet and we went in the house and, it kind of got into a thing for a minute very quickly. And I just said, I don't want to do this. I care too much about you, Rosa, and I don't want to engage in anything. It wasn't even like a disagreement. It was just like it was a something that she was thinking and feeling, and I respected that, and I just kind of reeled it in for myself, and it was very uncomfortable. It was really, really uncomfortable. It's like, when you have these relationships in life, and they always call it the honeymoon phase. Well, we've been seeing each other, or we've been talking almost a year, and seeing each other, I think about 10 months at that point, and so I don't know. I got really confused, and that's the only word I can really put on it, was I was confused because I knew that we had spent a lot of time together in different places, and I don't know. I thought, well, maybe she's just embarrassed of me, period. And that she has a right to her opinion and her feelings about those things. And so I had to reel in my shame self, and not go down the shame spiral. And it really hurt me in my heart, but I just didn't say a whole lot. And then the next morning came and she was going to be leaving to drive back up to a friend's house in Raleigh. And I was going to go to my mom's because it was going to be Mother's Day the day before. And so as she walked out of my house, I was on the porch and I was saying goodbye. And I knew when she was getting in her car that I probably wouldn't see her again. I just had a feeling about it. And it was like, I don't know what just happened, but I know that sometimes the universe brings people into our lives as quickly as the universe can take them out of our lives. And I didn't make any kind of decisions. I felt very shocked and I felt really sad and uncomfortable. But I sat in that discomfort because I can't run from it. There's nothing I can do to put a band-aid on it. Oh, there's plenty I could do to put a band-aid on it, but I choose not to. And so I packed up Minnie and it was time to go to my mom's, which was really not what I wanted to be doing because when you're feeling like that and you can't really tell your mom, I couldn't tell my mom all of this. I mean, we've never been able to really communicate about gay relationships. I don't even know why I call them gay relationships. I don't know if I was a heterosexual person, if I would tell her about my husband. You know what I'm saying? I don't even know if that would even be possible because there's just certain vulnerabilities that I've never been able to open myself up to my mom in those ways. So I drove up and Rosa called me and I just pulled into a rest stop and we talked on the phone for a minute and it kind of felt okay. But it kind of felt like it was, the elephant in the living room, like it wasn't going to be talked about. It was sort of like something that was going to get swept under the rug. But I knew I couldn't sweep something like that under the rug, that it felt like a bigger thing to me. And also, it felt like a very deeper issue than what was really being said. But that's none of my business. And I've learned how to stay in my lane and not try to get into someone else's head because I can't. So we just sort of said some niceties and then I went on and got to my mom's house and my mother's like, come on in, come on in. And she said, come on at, back here to the sun porch when you put your stuff up. And I had Minnie with me. And so I went with Minnie and we went out to the sun porch and my mom says, sit down, sit down. So I sat down and she turned her chair to me and she looked at me and she was kind of quiet for a minute. And she said, Jill, I was mean as shit to you growing up. And I went, oh, what? And I laughed. And she goes, no, hear me out. She said, you were born and you came out pushing against me. And I had to push back. And she said, you had your own style. your own ways, and those clothes. Well, when she said that to me, it was like a bell went off over my head. Ding, 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 ding. And it was like my mother, for the first time in my entire life, apologized to me for something. And I almost didn't even know how to deal with it. But a little voice inside of my head said, she just let you out of unworthiness prison. And I looked at her and I said, you know what, Mama? I said, I just want to say that I really, really appreciate you saying that to me. Because I said, that makes me feel really at peace. And I said, you know, I forgave all of this stuff many, many years ago, and I've spent a lifetime, my whole adult life, I had spent, you know, trying to forgive and trying to move forward and trying to better myself. But the validation I got, and it wasn't like, see, I told you, it wasn't anything like that. I think that my mom is facing her own death. You know, she's just turned 89, and I think she has days and days of loneliness and being alone, because that's kind of what she's chosen and how she's created her life to be. But I think she has a lot of time on her hands to think about stuff. And she went on to say, you know, Jill, you were good in basketball. You were good in all the sports. And she said, I never told you. And I could have told you, there were many times, and she said, I could just kick myself because I never told you. And I said, Mama, it's okay. I said, you know, I had to learn how to tell myself. I said, you know, and really on a deeper level, I thank her. I thank her and my father for not doting on me and not giving me too much and not doing all that, because it took me down a road of destruction, yes, by my faults, but also I had to learn how to start giving myself these things and complimenting myself for certain things. And if I walk by a window outside of a shop in a downtown street and I see my reflection, you know, I've had to learn to say, hey, Jill Haney, and not be like, God damn, fuck, are you fucking kidding? Because that was what I would do to myself, as I would walk by and I could look in a mirror and I could say, oh my God, you don't even need to be here. You don't deserve to be here. Who the fuck are you? You know, and I degraded myself and I hurt myself in so many ways, physically and psychologically, because all I knew was there was a certain way that we were supposed to look. There's a certain way that we're supposed to dress. There's a certain way we're supposed to act. There's a certain way we're supposed to be. And as women, especially, then that's a whole nother kettle of fish, man. Because if you're not the right size, or you're not petite, or you're not feminine enough, or you're not those things, then you don't fit in. And, you know, I'm not a victim to that bullshit. I used to be a victim to it. But I have to tell you, when, you know, when you have a relationship that maybe I'm just in denial, but I felt like was moving into a forward loving place and a future that looked really bright and fun and exciting. And, you know, I really wasn't looking for some like real heavy, like let's go get married kind of relationship. I love the phrase, you know, LAT, living apart together. It's the life, it's the best of both worlds, because, you know, you get to plan to see one another. And then when you do, it's exciting and you get to catch up on things and tell stories, because you're not in the day to day to day to day to day to day to fucking humdrum. And, you know, that, and if you want to fight about that, go ahead, fight with each other about it. But life does become that way a lot of times. I don't know how to do it in a way where it doesn't become humdrum. I'm willing and I'm open to try that on a one day at a time basis. But this situation felt really good and solid to me. And so it was like, you know, once again, I felt like this rug, this invisible rug, had just gotten pulled out from under me. And I'm not a victim, and I want Rose's life to be the best life that she can have for herself. And I want all her dreams to come true. And that was one thing that I had to go back to that Marianne Williamson always talked about in her book called The Return to Love. And she talks about, if you have someone in your life or a situation in your life that just really unnerves you or sets you into a catastrophic psychological doomsday, then do a 90-day prayer vigil for this person, place, or thing, and or situation. Pray for 90 days and light a candle and do a ritual for this person, place, or thing, and pray that all their dreams come true. And I had done this before in my life with people, and I knew that I had to start to do this because I didn't want it to grow into some anger bullshit thing that I would snap or say some things that I was going to regret. And I was proud of myself because I didn't participate in any kind of real argument or anything. I didn't, there was nothing to argue about. We're all entitled to our own beliefs and our own thoughts. And she was having feelings that I don't know what they were. And I honor that. If that's what needs to happen for her, then I have to let it go. And so that's what I had to do. And so that was very, it was a shock. And it was almost as if the whole hell in a grease shock had prepared me. I'd already been shocked and gutted enough. And with this, I guess I just thought, well, Jill, you can let this be horrible, or this can be a situation that might be one of the best things that's ever happened in your entire life. And that is really, for me, what's becoming my truth, is that things that seem catastrophic or bad or heartbreaks, sometimes those things are openings, and those, create new things to come into our path. Just like the Helen of Greece thing, when I talk about backtracking, about this whole thing started, never would have gone to Greece. I never would have met all these people. I never would have had this experience with Rosa. I would have never gone to Italy, maybe in years from now, but all of these things that transpired from just a thing that really hurt, then I know that all things work toward good. And for me, that's what I have to keep my focus on, is no matter what, they're all working toward good. And whatever this contrast was, that I knew that the expansion that is going to come from this is probably going to be life-changing and everlasting. And it will be so phenomenal that I'm not even going to be able to put it into words.
Hammered is recorded and produced in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Asheville, North Carolina. It's narrated by Jill Haney, produced by Jill Haney, and with sound design, editing, and music by Alexander Rodriguez. Our beautiful artwork was created by Lauren Caddick. And we'd like to send a special thanks out there to Minnie and Robin. You can check out our website, podcasthammer.com, and follow us on social media for updates.